News from the Bunker is brought to you by Tucker Survival.
Welcome to News from the Bunker, special report. We got a special guest in the studio tonight. Ron Jones is going to be talking to us about the history of the Spanish flu in America and around the world. He's got some fascinating information he wants to share. I know a lot of people are kind of comparing what we're going through with the coronavirus, Wuhan flu, that it's the same thing. I think after listening to what Ron has to say, you're going to find out that there's vast differences between the Spanish flu and what we're going through right now. So, Ron, why don't you tell us about yourself a little bit?
All right. Well, it's good to be in the bunker, man.
Yes. Glad you found your way here.
Yes, man. I was, as I said before we started taping, I was a little bit down, and I heard Ted Nugent's post, and I got fired up and decided it was time to give you a call and come to the bunker, man, and do my part. But my formal education is in kinesiology, and I'm a historical kinesiologist, which means I study the history of movement and the art of movement and the science of movement, but I'm also a credentialed health science teacher. So we're not talking about movement and physical education tonight, but we are definitely talking about health science. And you mentioned that what people think of the flu today is maybe not like the flu of yesteryear, and I get some criticisms like, well, we can't make a comparison of the flu, and it's different. I say, yeah, it's really different.
Yes.
So we're going to talk about that, because the 1918 flu was a killer, killer epidemic. And just to get this out there, my research data comes from the largest digital archive in the world for the 1918-1919 influenza pandemic in the United States. And it's a combination effort of University of Michigan, which University of Michigan, if you're into worksite wellness and public health and things like that, they have a great reputation there already. And also the Centers for Disease Control. And there are a lot of people that will push back in the CDC of today, but a lot of this data was published years ago, long before 2020 and any kind of politics that are going on now. And it's very well documented, very well researched. So at some point you have to hang your head on some kind of rack. Yeah. And I think it's pretty solid information. And I just, as a history person that has studied history for decades now, I'm just absolutely fascinated by what I've been learning about what actually happened 100 years ago. And one of my friends, he's a film documentary maker, he asked me, he goes, what are people saying? I go, they're basically not saying anything. They don't know what to say. I start talking about what actually happened, because I'm going to talk about different cities in the United States and what they actually did and the measures that they took. And there are similarities, but sometimes they're radically different. And so we might not agree today, we might not understand, but I think as a history person, it's just fascinating, and there's a lot to learn from it.
So I know I did a quick study when all this happened.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I do. If there's economy issues, I'll go back.
Right.
Depression, what would they do then?
Right.
So I did a quick study on the Spanish flu and found out just from that quick study, it's like, yeah, that was way different.
It was
very different, and at the speed at which it went through.
Yeah, at least I would say, from what I've read, and even the CDC has conflicting numbers, as I discovered in the last 24 hours. But what I'm citing tonight from the 2006 conference, Pandemic Influenza, Past, Present, and Future, Communicating Today Based on the Lessons from the 1918-1919 Influenza Pandemic, Centers for Disease Control, United States Department of Health and Human Services. They said that about 550,000 people died in the United States from that flu.
Yeah.
And we know, if you look at the global deaths, it was at least 50 million people, maybe as high as 100 million. It's pretty significant.
Yeah.
It was a killer. And in fact, they called it a hit-and-run disease because it came through very, very quickly. One of the things I've learned from looking at all this study, I've studied over a dozen different cities in the United States now on their summary reports. It came in quickly, and it left pretty quickly in comparison to what we're seeing today.
Yeah, that's what I had studied. It came, went, came back, and then it was just gone.
Yes.
Just disappeared.
And I've had some people criticize, well, you know, the second wave is like, well, let's talk about the second wave. Because the second wave is like, okay, here's the first wave. We know that it comes in and there's a big spike. And most of the second waves are kind of like that, or like that. I think it was Detroit. They had a pretty significant second wave. But the second wave was just a little bump. But if you took it, I kind of like to think of the danger zone, that really high infectious period. Typically, from what I've seen in my research on all this, is about 2 to 6 weeks. Like, it's in and it's out, and 2 to 6 weeks, they're opening back up. And yes, there were some cities that went longer. But basically, you started seeing it in American cities where there was action taken in late August, but it was probably more common in September into early October, before things started shutting down and restrictions were put in place. And then many cities by before New Year's, they were opening back up or opened back up and they were rolling. Some cities did roll through January, February with a tapering off period. But again, if you want to try to put it into a bumper sticker summary here at the beginning of the show tonight, about 2 to 6 weeks was the critical like danger zone period. And you know, by New Year's, a lot of cities were rolling. And it really, it was circulating in Europe before then and even in the United States. And there's some reports that it was actually circulating a couple years before then. It just wasn't as bad to get people's attention. But that's kind of the gist of it. It was very quick hitting. It was really, really harsh. 2 to 6 weeks, the worst part was done. Some cities shut the schools, some did not. Some put hardcore restrictions, like in Salt Lake City. Actually, the state of Utah shut the whole state down on October 10th, 1918. Basically just shut everything down. And then by December 30th, the schools were open again. So they had about a 5 week period, you know, where they were pretty locked down, and then they started to open. And then by the end of the year, you saw things all the way open again, for the most part.
And that's what's interesting to me, is the lack of technology that they had.
Right.
Even like the mask, because you can find pictures of them all wearing the mask.
Yeah.
You think about the mask in 1918 compared to like what we have now with the technology.
Yeah.
So the mask was probably pretty much worthless.
Yeah.
It's just cloth, you know. But they went through that pandemic and, you know, got on with their lives.
Yeah.
Dealt with it.
Yeah.
You know, the medical stuff was not really advanced,
right?
You know, and how they tried to deal with things.
Well, let's talk about the mask a minute, because I, you know, when this whole thing started, as a health professional, I'm like, well, what's the deal with the mask? I started reaching out to my PhD friends and people that were public health professionals, like, what's the deal with the mask? And there was some confusion with them. It's like, well, we don't need to wear the mask because, you know, CDC, it's in the next week. It's like, well, we got to wear the mask. I'm like, hey, man, they said to wear the mask now. It's like, so one of the things I was looking at when I got all this data, I mean, I got piles of stuff over here, is what do they do about the mask? And there was a lot of controversy about the mask.
Back then. Anti-mask.
People were arguing about the mask. They were pushing back on the mask. And some people, like Utah, did not have a state mandate, even though they shut the aggressive move to shut the state down. They did not decide to mandate masks. But if you look at San Francisco, because we're in California, and San Francisco up north, they had the most restrictive mask policies. And they also had some of the worst statistics in the whole country for the 1918, 1919
like
flu.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of controversy. The physicians were arguing about whether or not they were effective. Of course, they were probably, you know, maybe built out of different materials than today, and maybe not. I mean, a bandana, I don't know how much a bandana changes over the course of 100 years, but they were using chiffon masks, and they were trying to use masks that were more stylish for women. It was the same kind of a thing.
Same arguments, same things.
And it was cited that the people hated the mask.
Yeah.
They hated the mask. In fact, when San Francisco lifted the orders for the mask, it was cited in the summary report. There were like masks clogging up the drains. I mean, it was just like people just flung the mask everywhere. They couldn't wait to get rid of them. So from a human psychology standpoint, you know, in some ways we don't change a lot. We do want to interact with people. We do key so much off facial expressions. And one of the things that's so sad for younger people, and this is what we don't really know from a psychological trauma standpoint, is what kind of effect these masks are going to have on infants. I was at the post office the other day, and there was a little baby, I mean like a year old, in a stroller, and she had like a little mask on, and I was surprised she was actually wearing it, because my kids would have ripped it off, you know. And I had my mask on because, you know, you have to have the mask on the post office. And I'm looking at her and I'm trying to squint and smile, but she can't tell. And that's like, but her eyes locked and we're just looking at each other. And I'm like, I wonder what she's thinking, you know, because it's very disturbing. Now,
that's what concerned me.
Yeah.
Is babies, I mean, all they can go by is very basic.
You know, right.
What they see, what they taste,
yeah.
What they can feel. And the face is really important to baby bonding.
Well,
the mother and the father and different people in society.
If you get into human development, what they put in their mouths is critically important to how they learn about the world.
Yeah.
Their mouth is a sensory organ. And that's why they're constantly putting stuff in their mouths, even though it sounds nasty to us. It's part of an infant's development.
Yeah.
Like, I got to talking with some occupational therapist about this that work with children. They have a whole another skill set than I do, but they were enlightening me on the importance of the mouth as a sensory organ and a learning tool for infants. So yeah, it's all over the place. There were many different policies. I can tell you some big things I've got out of the report so far. One is that the whole country didn't do it the same way. Everybody kind of had a little bit different approach. Some worked better, some did not. What I'm seeing even in the reports from the 2006 conference where they brought all these experts in on the pandemic is that there's still some debate whether the social distancing was that efficient, which I thought was interesting that because I always thought, well, that's pretty much, you know, a standard strategy, and there's still some debate about how much that influenced actual infection rates.
Yeah.
But what I'm seeing is this, the ability for the United States in 1918 to come together quickly and make a decision and implement major changes sometimes happen in 24 hours. And I look at what's happening today and people are arguing and fighting and this thing's dragging out forever. And it's been cited in the data that when you don't do it right, the thing just hangs on and it doesn't go away. And that's exactly what we're seeing today.
And they did it without the technology.
They did it without the technology.
A lot of face-to-face meetings. And
I think people, one of the things that's been cited is that it's extremely important to be transparent with the information and tell the American people what's going on. Because when the American people know the truth, they're a lot better about, you know, getting on board and making a team effort. And that was super important in World War II. And that'd be a topic of another great show in an area that I've researched quite a bit, is the industrial side of World War II in terms of making decisions. But it's similar to the flu in terms of, like, a lot of people had to come together and make decisions very, very quickly because it was a life and death situation. So literally, there were cities that got together with a panel of experts, community leaders, medical professionals, and in 24 hours, they had made the decision and put everything into action. And this happened up in Seattle. In fact, Seattle did it so quickly. In the summary report, it said people went out. A lot of people didn't even know the city had shut down yet. They went out and things are boarded up, and they were like clueless or wandering around, like, well, what happened? I mean, it's like a bunch of cattle had nowhere to feed, you know? They were absolutely stupefied. It happened so quickly. And there was no messing around about it.
Yeah.
It's like, this is what we've got to do. So here's the thing, man. As a history person and someone that I like to think I'm reasonably intelligent if I have the right information, had we been transparent with the history of how this thing is managed, this thing meaning pandemics in general, I mean, really, like, how did they do it in 1918? I would have had a much different attitude going into this thing, and I think I would have been more compliant in certain ways because I would have known what people actually did. Now, unfortunately, today in 2020, there are so many people that think anything older than 10 years is irrelevant.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter anymore because we do things so much better. That's bull crap. You know, there's a lot to learn from history. And what we could have learned is, like, hey, man, we got to make some decisions quickly, and no one's going to like it, or at least everyone's not going to like it, but it's what we have to do. And I think just based on what I think I know now, after going through dozens of different summary reports from the largest database in the world on this situation, we could have been in and out of this thing in a lot less time. I don't know if it would have been 2 to 6 weeks. I'm not a medical expert, but I can tell you that in 1918, that was the hot zone period. Yes, there were cities that went a couple months and 3 months.
It's almost like their lack of technology worked for their favor. Because it's like, we have so much technology, we get analysis paralysis.
Yeah.
Well, we need studies, we need this, we need that. And back then, they didn't have any of that. It's like, they saw what was happening. All right, I think we need to do this.
Yeah.
And they took action.
They took really rapid action. That's something that has really kept coming up in all the reports. It doesn't matter what city that I read, even the ones that, like, quote unquote, lag behind the rest of the cities, they were so much more efficient than what we're doing today.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, we were like talking about it, it seems like, for a month before we did much of anything. So, there were some people watching. They might not like that, but I'm just telling you what happened, okay? I'm reporting what happened. And we might want to think that, our rights are being violated if we have to be told to do this or that. But that's just how you have to deal with a global pandemic. It's just the way that it is. And some of this stuff goes back to biblical times, certain things that people did. One thing that came up, too, was that a lot of schools did not shut down. And the premise for keeping the schools open was interesting. A lot of people felt like the children were much more protected and safer in a school. And it wasn't just maybe because there was family violence at home or there wasn't enough food. The medical community was much more integrated into the school system. So they had physicians in the schools and nurses, and they were checking the children every day. If the children were infected or they were sick, they were immediately sent home. And then they had a lot of quarantines in place in those days, although that varied by city too. But they were very, very well monitored at the schools. And then what the schools did, or the school sites did, is they collected all this data. So in Los Angeles, they used that. I wouldn't even say regional data. I'm going to say like neighborhood data, because this particular area, let's say if we're talking Los Angeles County where I live, Pasadena would have a different set of data than going down the street to Pacoima or someplace like that. So they would open up literally a certain neighborhood based on the stats, and that was contributed to Los Angeles being able to open up their schools so much more rapidly and efficiently, because they did it by pocket area. They didn't make a blanket decision to hold everybody down when there was only like one or two problem areas. I thought that, this is 100 years ago, there were no computers. Yeah. I thought this was very, very sophisticated. And very, very forward thinking. And so that seemed to be pretty universal across the country, is that the kids are better off in the schools. Now, today you're seeing, at least in California with the teachers unions, a huge pushback to keep the kids out of the schools. And the teachers don't like it. I'm a credentialed teacher in 3 different subject areas. So I just report the facts, and a lot of teachers don't like it. It's like, hey, man, I'm a teacher. I'm reporting the history. I'm reporting the information. And it's up to you to disseminate that and, think about it as you will. But it is what it is.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of kids stayed in school, and they used that data to manage the disease and get things up and running faster.
So speaking of data, let's dig into some of this data.
Well, let's talk about this.
I like data.
Yeah, and actually, this is about a 50-page report, and I've read the whole thing, and I can give you the link for this. If people just want to dig into, this is basically in 2006, it was a big workshop on the pandemic flu. And one of my public health professionals, she's enlightened me. It's like, hey, there was a plan in place. We might not have followed that plan, but there were a lot of plans and a lot of meetings and a lot of wisdom that came out of the previous influenzas. So I'll just read you a couple things from this. It's a fascinating report. If you really want to get into it, I highly recommend it. And it's written in a way that you can understand, because I've got some other stuff up here, like, unless you have a degree in statistics, it could be a little tough to get through. And here's something that in 2006, this is what they wrote. One of the things the secretary has recognized is that communication is as important as any other part of the response. Communication has been referred to as the social Tamiflu. We at HHS, that's the Department of Health and Human Services, recognize that if an influenza pandemic occurs, we will be the first generation to be faced with the additional demands of a 24-hour news cycle. They're recognizing the difference. Therefore, we must inform but not inflame. And this is written in 2006. They wanted to be transparent with the data and the information for the American people. They suggested we do not inflame and over-dramatize the situation. Now, the health director in Detroit was a hunter, and I know a lot of your listeners are into hunting. And because his knowledge on hunting, he understood the threat response and the adrenaline response in animals and how that taints the meat and things like that and what it does to the immune system. And so it wasn't just in Detroit, but also other cities. They were talking a lot about not creating a panic, because when people get in a panic state is when they make decisions that they shouldn't normally, or they wouldn't normally make. Yeah. Now, you know, in a survival situation, and the people you talk to, they're very big on not losing your head. And so that was also a prevailing thought in 1918. It's like, here's the information, here's what we need to do. We shouldn't be panicking, but this is the business.
Because we're seeing it, like that lady in San Diego, and the couple was eating and had their mask off, and she goes up and pepper sprays them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, that's kind of insane to be that paranoid. You're probably getting a lot of misinformation, and that's why the data is so important.
There's a lot of misinformation. That's the problem. There's like too much information. And, you know, I actually beat myself up a little bit, because as a history person, I've been wondering, like, well, what actually happened? And I'm surprised that I waited so long to really get into this, because I really didn't get into this until the summer. And I think that part of it, the trigger for me, was that they're talking about, you know, keeping the schools shut down into the fall. It's like, I'm not saying the school should open. I'm not saying they should be closed. But what I am saying is we need to start looking around and figure out what they did back in the day. And for the people say, well, this flu is not like the other flu. I agree. It's not like the other flu. But there are some things that we can learn from history. Yeah. And I'm not going to deny that. So as I mentioned, they're talking here about there was a minimum of 50 million people, possibly 100 million people that died in the 1918 flu. If you adjust for population, that would be 300 million today, it's cited. And this is fascinating. In 3 weeks in the 1918 flu, it killed more people than AIDS has in 24 years.
Wow.
That gives you, and this is written in 2006, so that gives you an idea of the killer punch of this flu. There was a 15 to 53% morbidity rate for this flu. In San Antonio, over 90% of the households had at least one family member with the illness. Most of the deaths occurred in healthy adults. In army camps, the death toll was routinely over 5%, sometimes as much as 10%, and in some communities as high as 30%. And with this flu, sometimes it was just a matter of hours and people were dead.
So this is like the classic definition of a pandemic.
Oh, this was...
Because when I started looking that up, you know, what is a pandemic?
Right.
You know, and it's something that's, you know, basically in every country on the planet, it's blasting through.
Yeah.
That is the true definition, and that's basically what this
And there doesn't matter what you do,